On a less somber or unpleasant note, there is also a letter from the year 2000 from the regional police headquarters in Szczuchow, thanking Jackowski for his help in establishing the identity of the burglars who broke into a house. Jackowski's version of events, different from that envisaged by the police, was fully confirmed, as was his description of the burglars, which enabled the police to apprehend them, and the police hope for future collaboration. There are letters from grateful families thanking him for help in locating relatives with dementia and other problems, who have wandered off, got lost but were found alive. He finds missing objects, art objects of great sentimental value stolen from well-known people, machinery and money, all confirmed by letters from relatives and grateful owners. There is also the case of finding a missing dog, working from a photograph, when the name of the street Kwiatkowska comes into his mind. The owner, in another town, in Bydgoszcz, went knocking on all doors along the street and someone had taken the dog in, as we are. Tkowska and Jackowski, 2012, Volume 2, pages 128-9. Jackowski's clairvoyance, the process. In all these cases we find varying volume of information provided, and, at least in some cases, we get clues as to the routes by which it is obtained. What they have in common is the focus on the intent, on reaching a target that can be quite complex, yet the starting point is a photo, sometimes not even a name, and a personal item. Retracing in detail the steps of a missing person, a murder victim or a criminal may be astounding enough, but in the case of the double murder and arson Jackowski homes in on the motive, and that involves describing a location that no longer exists and relationships that reach years into the past. He then suggests a future course of action that may not qualify as precognition, but is the kind of prediction that sounds very much like Smith's truncated causal chain involved in precognition. If the police question the murderer's girlfriend, she will break, which is in fact what happens. The truncated part is the clairvoyant knowing what the girl knows and her likely response. The outcome, the target is exactly what the police need, a route to the identity of the murderer, initially through motive. Yet in the case of the murder in Bydgoszcz, the motive remains unclear, and it may never have been clear to the murderer in a drunken state. What is important is evidence. Jackowski knows that evidence is a problem after so much time has passed, but what, apart from his intention to find it, could have led him to the shirt hidden in the sofa? If the memory of it had been in the mind of the perpetrator, he surely would have got rid of it. This brings to mind the comments by many of the sitters in the media mystic essay Tilda Copyright Answers of Mrs. Piper mentioned earlier, the impression that she digs out information buried somewhere in the recesses of their minds but not present in their conscious memory, Gould, 2022. When we examine the clairvoyant process in Jackowski's cases, it is very much as described by Joe McMonagall, starting with the initial taste, an intuitive clue with unknown, truncated, origin, which provides possibilities for combining intuitions with rational calculation. For example, when he is looking for two missing boys, case 7, his intuition tells him that they are dead, that there are two ponds, and the name Biskup is somehow involved. He then does some research using a map but eventually relies on intuition again to pinpoint the bodies. A similar situation arises when he locates a missing dog from a photograph brought by an elderly lady from Bydgoszcz, desperate to recover her companion, as we are. Tkowska and Jackowski, 2012, Volume 2 p. 128-130. He did not think he could do it, assuming that the information source of his clairvoyance had to be human, but he focused as he would for a human being and the taste was that the dog was alive. When the name Kwiatkowska jumped into his mind he looked up a map of Bydgoszcz on his computer and found Kwiatkowska Street at the other end of town from where the lady lived. In case 8, Jackowski senses death but has no understanding and no emotional clues. He draws a detailed map with a winding river, then has to calculate the distance from the road to the little bridge that he envisaged, and then he intuitively pinpoints a cement bollard next to the body. So, again as in the case of McMonagall, the taste is not enough, Both intuition and research are involved. As Jackowski recounts it, after the first taste there is a feeling of doubt, that he is only imagining things. He then tries to put the case to one side until the flashes start coming spontaneously. He then begins to get the atmosphere of the event. When he has an image in mind, he writes down what he senses and draws a map. Usually it is more than a vague idea of water, a forest or perhaps a road. It will contain very specific elements that can be verified before the actual search begins. The way that the information arrives also varies. It can be a bird's eye view, as in seeing a dead little girl. I saw her from above. She was lying there curled up. I could see her back. Why did I see her like that? Was she also perceiving herself from a bird's eye view at that moment? Janoska, 2018, p.29. This is the question that Jackowski asks again and again, in dozens of cases of drownings, where nobody knows the body's location and position. We then come to the question of psychometry. Jackowski describes the photos, the smelling and the handling of personal belongings as his technology, as we are. Tkowska and Jackowski, 2012, Volume 2 p. 130, and clearly he relies on the ritual. This is a very personal aspect of clairvoyance, since remote viewers, dowsers and indeed mediums have quite different procedures that do not involve psychometry. On the other hand, we do not know by what channels the information arrives in truncated chains, and the senses of smell and touch seem to be very significant for Jackowski, something particularly apparent in the case where he puts on the drowned man's dirty shirt and feels his presence. There are many clairvoyants with impressive track records: Ingo Swann, Bate Price, Eileen Garrett, or the Pole, Reverend Father Klimaszko, 41. Are some that spring to mind. However, the most relevant detailed comparative material in which to place Jackowski's cases in terms of reliable reporting and contrasting yet convergent targets and attitudes is provided here by two psychic virtuosi, Joe McMonagall and Stefan Osoki. Joe McMonagall. Background. Joe McMonagall, 1946. A distinguished American Army officer, now retired, has been described as the best operational remote viewer in the history of the U.S. Army's Special Project, Stargate. McMonagall, 2002, front page. He was selected for the remote viewing project by the Army because he was one of the small group of people who kept surviving the most dangerous situations against all odds in various ways, somehow knowing when something was about to happen in a particular location, to the point when others would mimic his actions in the field. After graduating from high school, McMonagall joined the U.S. Army. In 1978 he took part in a trial of psychic ability carried out on behalf of the Army by Russell Targ and Harold Puthoff at the Stanford Research Institute. He was one of six people selected for the project of remote viewing, generally now known as Stargate, and this was the beginning of his career as a remote viewer in the military, working on operational requests from various bodies, including CIA, FBI, Army Intelligence and a number of other agencies. He retired from his career in the Army after 13 years, with the Legion of Merit Award for Distinguished Military Service. McMonagall, 2006. His task as a remote viewer in the Stargate program was to locate and describe military and other facilities using geographical coordinates as targets, and to provide detailed descriptions of devices kept inside such facilities. The case described below is probably his most famous exploit and provides a detailed account of the process. The case of the Typhoon submarine, seeing the present and the future. There are many accurate accounts of the viewing of the Typhoon submarine, probably the best known, most detailed and perhaps the most astounding case of remote viewing. The one given here is based on that by Paul Smith, another famous remote viewer, a military outsider who later became an insider. Smith, 2015, pages 45-63, the story of the remote viewing of the Typhoon is not hearsay. It is not just another old war story that my fellow Stargate remote viewers and I expect you to believe just on our say-so. the provenance, the chain of custody, for this information is impeccable. Copies of nearly all the original documents that still exist became available when the CIA publicly released the Stargate Project's archives in 2004. Until then, they had been in the protective custody of the CIA. The account I had given in this book of the remote viewing of the typhoon is authentic, taken from the actual records and not from Anon's faulty memory. There were 10 remote viewing sessions over 2 months in the autumn of 1979. They were aimed at discovering what was happening inside the building at Shipyard 402 on the YC in what was then the Soviet Union. The remote viewers were Joe McManagall and Hartley Trent. They reported that inside the building the Russians were building submarines. This was regarded as impossible, because the building had no access to water, while the submarine described by Joe was totally unlike any known submarines, twice the size of anything that existed, built against the principles of naval architecture, with missile tubes in the wrong place. The National Security Council dismissed the data as fantasy. However, soon after, an enormous canal was excavated between the building and the water, and almost 11 months after the remote viewing sessions, the first Typhoon super submarine, of the new design precisely as described by Joe McManagall, was photographed in the new canal alongside the building on the 28th of September 1980. In the words of Paul Smith, at the time, I was serving as the strategic intelligence officer for the Special Forces Command in Germany and had not yet even so much as heard the term remote viewing. It was my job to review the latest top secret intelligence obtained by the Special Security Office in Munich. I still recall the almost panicked tone of the intelligence cables and briefs I read and passed on to the colonel. The Soviets had outmaneuvered the Western intelligence services, taking them completely by surprise, and both sides knew it. In this case, we also learn about the process of remote viewing, from Joe McManagall himself, McManagall, 2006, p. 124. His first target was a set of geographic coordinates from which he was able to describe the location and the facility. He saw the right place, a cold wasteland with ice, rocks, a very large industrial building and a harbor and sea with ice caps in the distance. Next, he was given a photograph of a large building of industrial type, near a large body of water, with general materials stacked outside, located somewhere in Russia. It later turned out to be Severodvinsk on the White Sea, p. 121. As he describes it, spending a considerable amount of time relaxing and trying to empty my mind, I imagined myself drifting down and slowly passing through the shed-like roof to the inside of the structure. I felt as though I was hovering inside a building that was the size of 2.5 to 3 shopping centers, all under one roof. I had completely misconstrued the size of the building. Here McManagall gives a detailed description of the inside, of giant bays between walls, scaffolding, interlocking steel pipes, cylinders being welded. I felt as though I were standing inside the building and able to actually see vividly what was going on. This rarely occurs in remote viewing, but for some reason it was happening on this target. My vision of the target was so precise that it almost seemed unreal. I had an overwhelming sense that this was a submarine, a really big one, with twin hulls. The case of the kidnapped general, this ability to focus extends to pinpointing the location of a kidnapped general and being aware of his thoughts. Brigadier General James Dozier, Deputy Chief of Staff at NATO headquarters in Italy in Verona, had been abducted in December 1981 by members of the Italian Red Brigade. Three remote viewers, including Joe, were charged with trying to locate him. They were given a picture of Dozier. Initially, they were not totally accurate about the course of the kidnapping, but all gave similar accounts. They targeted the general over a number of days and had similar impressions. We all reported him alive and having his eyes and mouth taped shut, with a set of earphones taped over his ears, as if he were being forced to listen to music he didn't like. A later, very successful session by McManagall started. With an almost perfect image of a coastline the right-hand side of Italy towards the north, it was followed by vivid images, which felt as if he was floating over the area, able to see what he wanted to see. He seemed to be following in the footsteps of the kidnappers. I suddenly found myself hovering directly over a fairly large town not far from the coast and just south and southeast of a very large mountain range. I moved closer to the ground and began to pick out roadways and buildings. I followed the roads and eventually found myself near a small central plaza, across from some kind of a fountain, and picked up the smells of a butcher shop, and the faint hint of a place where they did some kind of tanning or worked with hides. I got an image of a very large apartment building and settled in on the second floor. I came out of the session knowing that I could pretty much replicate the images and streets that I had seen. McMonagall produced a regional map that was specific enough to identify the city as Badua. He then sketched a rough street map, pointing out the location of the apartment house where the kidnapped general was being held on the second floor. General Dozier was released unharmed from an apartment in Padua after 42 days, not on the basis of the information provided by remote viewers, which was not used. However, the general judged their viewing accurate, especially stunning in thought content, the personal aspect. Information in our reports had originated within his own thoughts while he was being held, blindfolded, tape across his mouth, being forced to listen to hard rock, heavy metal music through headsets. McMonagall, 2006, pages 116-120. McMonagall also successfully finds missing persons and on at least two occasions accurately locates dead bodies, very much like Jackowski. This is something which was done spectacularly on one occasion by Stefan Osoki, although he is more famous for other things. Stefan Osoki, 1877-1944 picture. Background. Stefan Osoki became famous as a clairvoyant during the 1920s and 1930s, achieving international fame through the experiments carried out with him by such renowned researchers as Gustav Jelly and Charles Richer, and published contemporaneously in Revue Métapsychique, the Journal of Institut Méthode Copyright Tapsychique International. However, Osoki was never a professional psychic, and by the time he became well known he was already a man in his 40s, with a turbulent life story behind him. He came from a wealthy family of a Polish industrialist settled in Russia, and was heading the family business when the Soviet Revolution upended his life. He came to Poland in 1918 and became active as a businessman again, but it is his career as a psychic that really took off at this point, working with a very active group of psychical researchers from Poland and abroad. He never used his psychic abilities for financial gain or personal betterment, and put himself at the disposal of researchers. Most of the experiments with Osoki involved concealed, usually in sealed envelopes, writing or drawing, occasionally photos and packages with various objects. Sometimes the description of the wrappings and their history appears even more impressive than the successful identification of the target, as when the clairvoyant recounts the history of the box containing the target, and describes accurately where and who bought the cotton wool in which it was wrapped. Barrington et al., 2005, pages 71-72. At the International Congress of Psychical Research in Warsaw in September 1923, a high point in the history of psychical research was reached when the then SPR's research officer Erik Dingwall, who had prepared the target, an intricately wrapped drawing and writing, confirmed that the package had not been opened and drew it on the blackboard next to the drawing previously made by Osoki. It was a perfect match. Dingwall, 1924, Barrington et al., pages 62-64. Alongside the experimental evidence, there are also many real-life cases corroborated in detail by witnesses. They involved locating missing objects or persons with the aid of psychometry, that is, handling an object associated with the target. Osoki was also responsible for a unique and almost accidental case of pure clairvoyance, when in 1935, he described accurately the contents of a package, which were unknown to anyone living. The package was mislaid and in the meantime the person who created it had died 10 years before the experiment took place without revealing its contents to anyone. Barrington et al., 2005, pages 80-84, Samkzyuk, 2014. A quite distressing case, where the nature of the target was known but its location was obscured by the presence of some 700 similar targets in its proximity, involved the identification of a corpse in a mass grave. Again, the information required was not known to anyone living. A body in a mass grave. The account, which follows, is confirmed by Osoki's widow, who described her late husband's experience. Letter to Zofia Osoka from Jerzy Olwierski, dated 27 August 1946. Dot. My brother, Ensign Janusz Zolwierski, was killed during a cavalry charge in the locality of Palmyra near Warsaw, on 22 September 1939. After being exhumed from the battlefield, his body was put into a collective grave of about 700 Polish cavalry soldiers in the parochial cemetery of Kilpin, district of Lomianki near Warsaw 42. I intended to transfer his remains to our family vault in Radom, and try therefore to locate the approximate place where his body lay in the over 200 meters long grave. The task seemed hopeless. I therefore contacted and visited, together with my mother, engineer Stefan Osoki, to whom I brought a photograph and a letter written by my brother. After examining both, Mr. Osoki drew a detailed sketch of the cemetery and the grave, marking the spot where my brother lay. He further defined the cause of my brother's death, a heavy wound on the right side of the abdomen and groin. He also stated that he had died unattended after an hour in great pain. The sketch contained details of which we were unaware, for example, the belfry. On our entreaties, Mr. Osoki attended the exhumation in September 1940. Before the digging began, we left him alone, at his request. After walking up and down the burial ground several times, Mr. Osoki stopped and said that was the spot where my brother lay, it corresponded to the one marked on the sketch, and that the corpses lay in great disorder in several layers. Upon this, the workers began the digging, supervised by Mr. Osoki. After setting several bodies aside, he told us the next one would be the one of my brother and asked for it to be taken out of the grave. After it had been washed, my mother, sister and I recognized the body by the stature, military rank, personal garments and gold crown tooth. The doctor attending the exhumation found the wound to the right part of the abdomen and groin. The clenched fingers proved that my brother had died in great pain. Barrington, 2005 p. 116. In the original letter there are two comments not included in the previous versions. The Germans denied the permission to move the body, so I interred my brother again and marked the spot. Only after the war did I transfer his remains to the family vault. A few weeks after the experiment, Mr. Osoki told me that while walking along the grave in Kilpin he had clearly seen my brother's ethereal form. Jerzy Olwierski. Since the publication of the book by Barrington et al., some unpublished notes came to light which Osoki's widow, Zofia, was making for a program about her husband. This account is not first-hand and not corroborated, but it does come from someone who did her best to preserve Osoki's legacy, and make it available to researchers. In her notes, Zofia talks about the difficulties faced by Osoki on that occasion, and about the lost manuscript of Immortality, the book Osoki was working on at the time of his death, which contained an account of this experience. According to her, the experience was very stressful for the clairvoyant, so he tried to focus, asked for God's help and began calling the missing man in his mind. After a while, he saw in front of him what looked like a long, vertical, misty shadow, which slowly moved towards the longest of the graves, of which there were a few. He then followed the shadow, called for the people with the spades to follow him, and pointed out where they should dig, about the middle of the grave. The top layer of the soil was removed. The first bodies were those of a major and some officers, all of them in a state of disarray. From the outset, Osoki stated that the body of the cadet would be found deeper, and that was what happened. When the ninth body was brought up, he called out, without looking, that that was Janusz Zolwierski. And, finally, a case of viewing very distant past. The ancient settlement of Biskupin. During 1936 to 1942, Professor Stanislaw Poniatowski, an ethnologist, carried out a series of archaeological experiments with Osoki. Poniatowski was looking for information about prehistoric cultures, and believed that Osoki could supply it clairvoyantly, using psychometry to connect to specific cultures in the past, very much as he did when he connected through the objects he was given to hold with their owners and their circumstances. For a variety of reasons, one of them the probable misidentification of the psychometric objects by the archaeologist, the 33 experiments held under carefully controlled conditions and witnessed by a number of university professors gave very mixed results. 43. However, this experiment, in 1937, resulted in a remarkably precise description of a distant location that was still to be fully excavated and therefore contained information unknown to anyone. The location was the settlement of Biskupin, in north-central Poland, discovered in 1933, now known to date from the 8th century. Excavations started in 1934. Poniatowski was the only person who knew that the piece of ceramic that served as the psychometric object came from Biskupin and, since very little of the area had been excavated, Osoki's description seems to have been based purely on clairvoyance. He described people and animals, of greatest interest to Poniatowski, but it is the nature and environment of the settlement for which there is reliable verification. Excerpts from Osoki's narrative. Valleys. Enormous areas underwater. Rows of wooden single-story houses, one line separated from the next one by some 30, 40, up to 50 steps. The impression as if there was a whole city, a small town built on such stilts. I am losing it now. Water. I see these parallel planks, stretching far. Trees cut down, rough, all covered in moss and, if you look down on it, it's like one enormous roof. And from a distance they are separated by these trees. Whole row of houses, in one direction, and another. 15. A strange entrance, now I see. And then from here it goes down and there is lots of water. There is water here as well, but further there is more and it goes. River, not a river. A lake of some sort. Such rows I see. Difficult to draw. There is a road. And a passage to the water. I see 5, 7, 8 rows like that, and then it is blurred. From the shore I see a wooden fence that stops the water flooding this whole apparatus. But it is all wood. Thin. Quite technical. And here to the right diagonally, shows on the drawing, these animals. Within the fencing, and then enormous forests all around. Biskupin was a fortified settlement on the peninsula of Lake Biskupin. Originally it was an island, about 100 meters from the shore. Along the shores of the peninsula there was an oak pine palisade, consisting of a number of rows, intended both as a breakwater and a defensive measure. The main defensive construction was a rampart built of wooden soil, with a gate and a wooden bridge, which linked the island to the mainland. Inside the rampart there were 106 houses arranged in 13 rows, divided by 11 parallel streets, which joined the widest and longest ring road. The tops of the houses touched each other and had similar dimensions, similar skeletal construction and similar household equipment. Osoki's description of the enormous areas underwater, rows of wooden houses, a town built on stilts with wooden ramparts protecting it from flooding, is thus accurate. However, the most exciting remarks came at the end of the experiment. Here where the settlement ends, there is a lot of water and beyond the water there is yet another city, larger than this one. It does not exist anymore, but is at a distance of 1 kilometer, only larger, now buried. Enormous city. Beyond the lake. The same people, in this other city. Now there is a forest there. A town on land, but buried. That lake flooded that city. The local Lusatian settlements were not thoroughly researched until after the Second World War. Osoki's statements about another, enormous city north of Biskupin were verified, obviously only to some extent, in the second half of the 20th century, towards the end of the 1950s, when excavations 10 kilometers north of Biskupin revealed a previously unknown settlement from the Lusatian culture, probably some three times larger than the settlement at Biskupin. Kinds of clairvoyance, what they have in common.